history, The Devil's Dream, and The Bubba Stories, the fiction of Lee Smith, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for part four in a continuing series of programs highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. Novelist and short story writer Lee Smith is here now to read from and talk about her work.
When Katie Cocker answers a question, she leans forward on her stool and speaks right to the one that asks it. She looks you dead in the eye. "That's a pretty complicated question for me to answer," she says now, slowly, to the woman from the BBC. "I have to admit, there was a time when all I wanted to do was get out of that valley. I was just dying to get away from home. What I didn't understand all those years when I was waiting."
Novelist and short story writer Lee Smith. She'll be back in just a moment to read from her work and talk about the modern American South. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. This program is made possible by a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. By way of economic advances, educational leadership, and the pursuit of racial harmony, progress has become characteristic of life in the contemporary South. But even though nowadays the South is home to international business, big-time sports, and world-class universities, it's a region where people look to the past in ways that tie their everyday lives to bygone times. Many Southern writers seize upon that doubleness as an organizing principle important in their novels, poems, and stories. Writer Lee Smith is a case in point. Her books are fictional guides to the Southern landscape, drawing on the power of history itself and presenting Smith's readers with a palpable sense of Southern manners and customs. Ranging in focus from small-town politics in Alabama to parodies of modern romance, to the grittiness of mountain life in the Southern Appalachians, to an artistic genealogy of country music, to meditations on how Southern writers create themselves, Lee Smith explores the New South, but sees it through the prism of the old. She often does this with attention to the lives and voices of women, women whose stories show Southern life in the country and in the city, and women whose experiences capture what Lee Smith calls the lure of the road and the dream of home. Lee Smith is the author of 8 novels and 2 collections of stories. She's here now to read from one of her books, a novel entitled Oral History.
"I'll tell it all, but don't you forget it's Almarine's story. Almarines and Pricey Janes, and Lord, yes, it's that red-headed Emmy's. Might be it's her story more than the rest. If'n 'twas my story, I never would tell it at all. There's tales I'll tell and tales I won't. And if'n 'twas my story, why, I'd be all hemmed in by the facts of it, like Hoodow Holler's hemmed in by them 3 mountains. I couldn't move no way but forward. And often in my traveling over these hills, I have seed that what you want the most, you find off the beaten path. I never find nothing I need on the trace, for an instance. I never find airy a thing. But I am an old, old woman, and I have traveled a lot in these parts. I have seed folks come, and I have seed them go. I have cotched more babies than I can name you. I've put the burying quilts around many a soul. I said I know more than you know, and might be I'll tell you more than you want to hear. I'll tell you a story that's truer than true, and nothing so true is so pretty. It's blood on the moon, as I said. The way I tell a story is the way I want to, and if you mislike it, you don't have to hear."
Lee Smith, welcome to the National Humanities Center. It's such a pleasure to hear you read from your work.
Well, thank you.
You just read to us here from Oral History. This is a book that came out, 10 years ago?
Right.
1983 at any rate. Here is a voice that speaks to us, Granny Younger, whose narrative in this book sort of suggests the shape of Southern history. Are you something of a Southern historian as well as a novelist?
Well, I think I am. But I've done so much work in oral history, recording my relatives, recording other people, that I've kind of, frankly, I have despaired of ever getting at the whole truth exactly the way it was. Because, Wayne, I know, you know, when you interview, say, five people that were at the same event,
right. You
get five complete stories. And so this has made me feel like that it's always the storyteller's tale, if you will. I like to go at it through differing points of view, hoping that somehow for the reader some cumulative sense of what it was like at any particular point in time and place will come through. But I'm scared to just say it myself flat out.
What should we call it? Imaginative history?
That's pretty good. Not
history from the standpoint of the historian. Do people sort of run when they see you coming? Do you have a tape recorder in your mind, or do you actually carry one around with you? How do you get this marvelous flow of the speech and the way Southerners talk and behave with one another?
Well, you know, I think really, finally, we cannot choose our best material. It is simply given to us.
Uh-huh.
And it all has to do with where we're born and how we grow up and how we first hear language.
Now, that's what? Southwest Virginia?
Southwest Virginia, the coal fields, specifically the town of Grundy, Virginia. And I was born into a family of big talkers. And so I just don't have, I mean, that's what I hear when I hear a story. This is the language it comes in. And it's funny, you know, because I've been teaching in colleges for 20 years. But the language I hear in the faculty lounge is not the language that the stories come to me. And, of course, I spend a lot of time up in the mountains today still.
Let's talk about your sense of yourself as a Southern writer. We look back to people like Faulkner, and we look back to people like Wolfe. We pay homage, and yet the South is changing.
Well, now, wait a minute. Just back up one thing. For me, I'll tell you frankly, when I was in college and I signed up for a class in Southern writing with Lewis Rubin, we read Faulkner. And it was like, I mean, as far as I was concerned, it might have been set in New York or Greece or something.
That didn't seem Southern to you?
No, because, see, I'm from the Appalachian South. It is completely different.
In what ways? Let's pause on that for a moment.
Okay, well, for one thing, in the county that I grew up in, there were no black people. There were no rich people. There was no land that was worth a damn. I mean, all the land had been, you know, sold off. First for lumber, then for coal, and so on. So nobody had this this love of the land. There was no upper class, really.
But there was a sense of genealogy. Now, I mean, that's fundamental to your books,
also
extends into what we call Southern writing.
But you didn't
not?
Have a sense of an upper class. I mean, there were no columns. In that county, except on the Baptist church, the big Baptist church in Grundy.
Well, now, how did you get a sense of yourself, therefore, as a, should we say, simply as a writer and not necessarily as a Southern writer? I take it that you don't really struggle with that kind of category or label.
It just doesn't even, I mean, because you got to write about what you know.
Uh-huh.
And you got to write about the kind of people that you know something about.
Uh-huh.
So I don't struggle with it. I guess probably for me, one of the most important moments of my life as a writer was when I was actually, I think I was maybe a sophomore or junior in college, and I started reading a book named River of Earth. By James Steele, who is an old man from Kentucky,
and a wonderful
writer.
What did this do to you?
It just completely blew my mind, as we used to say in those days, because it was all about this family living a hardscrabble kind of a life in exactly that part of the country that I was from. And then, get this, at the end, their lives are so hard that they all pack up and they get in the car, kind of like the Jodes or something. They get in the car, and they're going to find a better life, and they head for Grundy. which is where I was from.
And you're saying, wait a minute.
I said, hey, don't do that. But the thing was, it was the first time I saw that word, Grundy, in print. It was like the town I was from was in a book.
Uh-huh. Made it real.
Which is not only a book, it's just an absolutely excellent novel.
It's like being on TV today. You got to do it in order to be real.
It's just, I can't tell you what that just kind of meant to me. Another big influence, though, was a person from the Deep South, Eudora Welty.
Oh, my goodness, sure.
Because she wrote about simple lives. I mean, she wrote about people to whom not much had happened, which was all the kind of people that I knew. And so she was a real influence, too. But as far as this sense of doom and grandeur and, you know, neurasthenic women lying down being fanned by darkies and stuff, I mean, forget it. I just could not identify with all that.
Give me a sense of this most recent book, which is called The Devil's Dream. Here you're going to read to us in the voice of Katie Cocker. Tell us about Katie a little bit, and then we'll listen to you read.
Okay. Well, now, this book covers... This covers a lot of time. It goes from pre-Civil War up to Nashville of the present time. And it's about a singing family in country music.
Is it a history of country music?
Well, it kind of is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But also, I always get really off on the characters. And I was trying to write a book, Wayne. I know this sounds weird, where it's more like an album.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like a record.
Right.
So that each section is somebody's song. And there's somebody talking in each section, and it's hopefully it's sort of circular, and it adds up to more of a record than a novel.
So what you're doing is sort of supplying us with the liner notes.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. But what I was doing, too, with the almost too obvious metaphor of being able to sing your song or not being able to sing your song, I was really writing about particularly women in Appalachia. And the possibilities for our lives and how those possibilities have changed over time.
All right, we're going to listen to you read from The Devil's Dream, and then we'll come back and talk about some of this.
When Katie Cocker answers a question, she leans forward on her stool and speaks right to the one that asked it. She looks you dead in the eye. "That's a pretty complicated question for me to answer," she says now, slowly, to the woman from the BBC. "I have to admit, there was a time when all I wanted to do was get out of that valley. I was just dying to get away from home. What I didn't understand, all those years when I was waiting for my life to start, was that it had already started. I was already living it. Those were the most important years, and I didn't even know it. But I was real young then and foolish, like we all are. I wanted to be somebody different. I wanted to be me. And I thought the way to do this was to put as much distance as possible between me and Grassy Branch. So I did that. And I took some chances, and I got knocked down flat a couple of times. I guess you could call me Phi Beta Kappa at the School of Hard Knocks. But I'd get right back up and keep on going. I made a lot of mistakes. I thought I had to do it all by myself, see. It took me a long time to understand that not a one of us lives alone, outside of our family or our time, and that who we are depends on who we were and who our people were. There's a lot of folks in this business that don't believe that, of course. They think you can just make yourself up as you go along. The trick is to keep on moving. But I can't do this. I come from a singing family. We go way back. I know where we're from. I know who we are. The hard part's been figuring out who I am, because I'm not like any of them, and yet they are bone of my bone. Tragedy of my life that I can't sing. I want to say that all my life I've been told to just move my mouth. And this is my revenge, is this book.
Yeah. Lee, you've just read to us from The Devil's Dream. What is the status of women in the South? I mean, do you address questions like that in your fiction? Do you think of yourself as doing that?
Well, actually, I don't usually think of anything when I'm doing it. It's like I just kind of put myself on automatic pilot. Right. And write a book. But then later I might realize what that book's about.
Well, what does Katie represent here? You've just read to us in the voice of Katie
Coffin. Well, I'll tell you, in this particular novel, Wayne, there are in fact two Katies. There is an earlier Katie,
right,
a girl from a fiddle-playing family who marries a preacher's son.
Yeah,
who,
Moses Bailey.
Yeah, and he won't let her fiddle or have any music because he believes that's all associated with the devil.
He comes in and he says, if I see you guys with a fiddle, that's the devil's dream.
And I'll
forsake you.
That's right.
We don't want to let the cat out of the bag here in terms of the plot, but that's really the incident that drives the whole novel.
It is. Mm. And in fact, she is denied a voice. Essentially, in how she wants to live her own life.
And generations later, we find this voice.
Yeah, and generations later, we go down through the Bailey family, and we come to the final Katie, mm-hmm. whose name in the book is Katie Cocker, and she's the narrator of the final section. And she not only is able to fiddle and sing, but she writes her own songs, and she records her own music. She's producing her own records, so she's having a say in the world. And
now, is this a form of Southern feminism? That is to say, that old-time sense of manners and courtesy and love and genealogy with that kind of brittle edge of modern feminism around it? How does it work?
I don't know. I reckon it is. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's also complicated because our final image of Katie is that, in fact, she is very much in control of her business, of her life, and so on. But our final image of her is she's in a tour bus, kind of driving across America, in fact, insulated from everything that nourished her, cut off by the soil, by the people. She has these little twin boys in Nashville that are playing lacrosse, and she doesn't even know what lacrosse is.
That's bittersweet.
That's it. It is. Uh-huh. It is. I mean, is that a victory? You know, and I think that always the South has been in conflict about one thing or another, and that's certainly true now, and we see it reflected in country music, and that's why it's such a great thing to write about.
Oh, listen, I mean, I've become a great country and Western fan. One, you can understand the lyrics. Two, it tells stories.
Oh, yeah.
And what would be the third thing? I mean, there is just that wonderful plaintive sense of people who are familiar to you.
Oh, yeah. And it's just
it's
talking about the issues that are the ones that we deal with in life in the South today. For instance, in that final thing, what we're talking about is the lure of the road versus some dream of home. We're talking about the country and the city and the pulls there. And, I mean, that's what we're all dealing with. And what do we lose when we make it? I mean, it's all very complicated.
Those are enduring themes, not only in the literature of the South, but in all literature.
Oh,
I
absolutely.
Think it's fair to say.
Sure.
Lee, are you trying to change the South? I mean, as you write about the South, your books, you know, we got, a half a dozen of them here in front of us, all the way from oral history up through Me and My Baby View the Eclipse and now The Devil's Dream and the new one that you're working on. Do you have a sense of doing something to the South rather than simply reflecting the South? You want to change it? You want to mirror it?
Oh, well, sure, I'd like to change it.
In what way?
Well, I certainly would like to address those things that still need more work, such as women still need to have more of a voice in their lives. African Americans, migrant workers, all kinds of people who are in fact now Southerners need to be considered as Southerners mm-hmm. and treated as such. I mean, we have many, many social problems to address and to deal with in the part of the country where I'm from, where the coal is being mined out, the jobs are going. The social problems are just enormous.
Does that mean that the villains in your books are always going to be white male conservatives?
No, uh-uh, no, not at all, uh-huh. not at all, because I think too often, you know, too often we all conspire in our own downfalls.
the human heart in conflict with itself.
With itself,
right.
Fair enough.
Lee, I want you to read to me again from your fiction. This is a selection from a story that itself has the title The Bubba Stories. It came out in a couple of collections of Southern fiction. Whose voice are we about to hear?
Well, this is the voice of Charlene Christian.
And she's talking about?
She's talking about when she was very young, how she wanted to be a writer. And her sensibility is kind of close to mine, although I didn't do what she does in this excerpt.
Fair enough. Let's listen.
Even now, when I think of my brother Bubba, he appears instantly, just as he was then, rising up before me in the very flesh, grinning that one-sided grin, pushing his cowlick back out of his tawny eyes, thumbs hooked in the loops of his wheat jeans, bass wedges held together with electrical tape, leaning against his little green MGB. John Leland Christian III, Bubba. In the days of his glory, Dartmouth College, 1965. The essence of cool. The essence not only of cool, but of bad. For Bubba was a legendary wild man in those days. And while certain facts in his legend varied, this constant remained. Bubba would do anything. Anything. I was a little bit in love with him myself. I made Bubba up in the spring of 1963 in order to increase my popularity with my girlfriends at a small woman's college in Virginia. I was a little bit in love with them, too. But at first I was ill at ease among them, a thistle in the rose garden, a mule at the racetrack, Cinderella at the fancy dress ball. Take your pick. I was into images then. More than anything else in the world, I wanted to be a writer. I didn't want to learn to write, of course. I just wanted to be a writer. And I often pictured myself poised at the foggy edge of a cliff someplace in the south of France, wearing a cape, drawing furiously on a long cigarette, hollow-cheeked and haunted, trying to make up my mind between two men. Both of them wanted me desperately. But in fact, I was Charlene Christian, a chunky, size 12, picked up from a peanut farm near South Hill, Virginia, and sat down in those exquisite halls to the intervention of my senior English teacher. I had a full scholarship. I would be the first person in my whole family ever to graduate from college, unless you counted my Aunt Dee, who got a certificate from the Beauty College in Richmond. I was not going to count Aunt Dee. I was not even going to mention her in later years, or anybody else in my whole family. I intended to grow beyond them. I intended to become a famous hollow-cheeked author with mysterious origins.
Lee Smith, we've just heard you read to us in the voice of Charlene Christian from the Bubba Stories. Let me push you a little bit here. You
All
sure
right.
This isn't you? I mean, it had to. It's got to be.
Well, it's kind of me. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of me. I mean, the family is made up, and I didn't, in fact, invent a brother because I wasn't smart enough to think of it.
But in a way, what you're doing here is telling us about how writers, not simply the ambition of being a writer, but the way writers work by inventing people.
That's right.
Bringing
That's
your
right.
imagination. To bear
yeah.
on them. Is there anything particularly Southern going on here in this story?
Well, I think so because, as I say, because the South has for so long been a really cut-off kind of place, a really shut-off and some would say backwards kind of place. And so when I was young and I went off to college from Grundy, Virginia, and wanted to be a writer, I thought that meant that that the last thing in the world I would ever want to write about was Grundy, Virginia, or anybody I knew there. I tell you, my last image before I left home was my mother and two of my aunts were sitting on the back porch discussing endlessly whether one of them had colitis or not. And, man, I couldn't wait to get out of there.
And now that's what you do write
now
about.
Now that's what I write about. But it was important to me to get some distance, though. To get some perspective. I mean, I think if I'd stayed right there, I probably wouldn't have seen that as something to write about. I would have wanted to write about glamorous people in London or something, like Charlene does in this the Bubba story.
Lee, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What are the special challenges or burdens or responsibilities, problems in the South that you see as a Southern writer that you want to address as a person and as a writer?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I think that in the deeper South, race has been an enormous issue. It is less so in the Appalachian South, where I'm from. I think what we're addressing there now is simply poverty and ignorance, the lack of education, the lack of possibilities, the fact that as families break up and jobs become more and more scarce, people are left without a sense of who they are and where they came from, and the fact that they can't anymore, you know, live on the land that their fathers have left of them. And so I think what we're addressing is all kinds of social changes that are being visited upon people who are very ill-equipped to deal with them. And so poverty has been one of my main things that I have thought about. And Lord knows, birth control. One of my novels, Fair and Tender Ladies, one of my sons just read it. Right. And I said, well, what'd you think? And he said, well, it's all about birth control, isn't it? And I said, well, maybe it is.
Fair enough. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. You've just heard part four of New Southerners, a continuing series of programs highlighting the work of contemporary Southern writers. My guest was novelist and short story writer Lee Smith. Her most recent book is The Devil's Dream. The music you heard is from an album with that same title and featured the Tarwater Band. Upcoming segments in New Southerners will present Clyde Edgerton, Kay Gibbons, Dory Sanders, Jill McCorkle, Tina McElroy Anza, Brent Wade, Randall Keenan, and Robert Olin Butler. For a cassette tape of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 696. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. The program number is 696. Special thanks for help in the production of this program go to Pat Schreiber and Richard Schramm at the National Humanities Center. This program was made possible by a major grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.